Well, this past Friday evening, we had a really enjoyable gathering in the parish hall. I'm wondering who was there at the family dinner. Do we have, I think there's about maybe 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 people. Okay. Anyways, we had a wonderful conversation. We ate dinner together. There were about 24 adults, about 12 kids. We all ate dinner together, and then the children went off and watched a movie, and the adults joined in conversation about the story that we just heard, a great synopsis of the story of Joseph from the book of Genesis. And in the story, we found a range of fodder for different discussions. The dynamics of family relationships, the dynamics of class struggle, the use of power for good or ill, the role of dreams, nighttime dreams, in our process of self-realization, the winding, sometimes fortuitous twists and turns that life brings us through, and the question of whether we can forgive injuries that are inflicted upon us, injuries that by most standards would not be forgivable. And we talked about our feelings about the Bible itself. Does this ancient text that emerges out of a culture and a time that is so alien from our own, does it still have something to say to us? Does it still have something universally true to reveal about the struggles of human life and the workings of the Spirit? And as to that question of whether the text still has anything to say, I would suggest this, which I found to be clear in the conversation that we had, that by interacting with the stories, by interacting with each other around the stories, it's that dialogue that brings about the revelation, what revelation is to be had. Our willingness to use the story as a mirror, our willingness to share with each other what we see in it, that invites the Spirit of guidance to speak to our lives through the conversation. And as a mirror in which to see ourselves, the story of Joseph serves very well. It's a long story, and it spans over 20 years of this main character's life. It has many chapters, and it's very, very detailed, unusually detailed for a biblical story. It's focused almost entirely on the complexities of human relationships, the intimate and turbulent relationships of families, the relationship between people who are thrown together under the same roof but are separated by their extreme differences in class and power, and the relationship between those who rule with or over those who are ruled by. And the fact that it's so detailed emphasizes that this is a human story rather than a mythic story. And while God is a presence in the story, God is not a character in the way that God is a character in the story of Noah or the story of Adam and Eve. The God in the story of Joseph is a non-personified influence. And this influence is revealed very subtly through twists of fate, through dreams, through human choices and chance encounters, through the human qualities of intuition and intelligence and beauty, and through the awakenings of conscience and forgiveness. So this is a God that whispers and hints and nudges and provides opportunities. Perhaps this is a little more of how we might understand a God in our own lives, even whether we use that word or not, that spirit that nudges and guides us towards our own unfolding, more than we might relate to the God of who strolls through the garden in almost human form and scolds his creations and is a puppet master on the stage of the history of the world. So this is a more subtle understanding. Well, there's far too much in this story to deal with. And even we got kind of the whole arc from the wrap presentation, but I want to take some time to tell an abbreviated story, version of the story. And I know that probably about a quarter of you were there on Friday night, so you've heard some version of this, and I beg your apology to be repeating it, although you can never tell the story the same way twice. I also want to recognize that it's because it's such a complex story, there are many different lenses with which it can be interpreted. There's many different ways it can be told. Anyone who would tell it would tell it a slightly different way. And this is very clear if you read Bill Moyer's discussion of it, or rather the discussion that appears in Bill Moyer's book on Genesis, which is a discussion between different scholars and cultural leaders and religious leaders. You can see how variously they come to it. There's a lot of tension in that conversation. There's a lot of argument. There's disagreement. And so it makes it very clear there's no final telling of this or any biblical story. It's just a mirror of ourselves. It shows us how we see, how we question, what questions do we bring to it. It shows us what we want to know. So the version I'm about to share with you is admittedly my version. But also I'm slanting it toward family relations. And we're coming up on Thanksgiving and on Christmas. We're coming up on the winter holidays. And this is a season that brings with it heightened awareness of our families, our feelings about our families. And that heightened experience of our families may be because we're close to our families and connected to them. It may be because we are alienated. It may be because we're going to be spending time together. It may be because we can't spend time together. We're separated by distance. But whatever's going on for us with our families, we have lots of layers of feelings about them. And the holidays tend to bring that to the surface. And so that's why I'm going to focus in that particular way. So the story begins with Joseph at age 17. He is indeed a golden boy. He's his father's obvious favorite. His father spoils him, gives him special things, gives him special treatment. He's very beautiful. He's very intelligent. He's precocious. And to put it bluntly, he knows it. And he gloats on that. And he's a braggart. And he likes to cultivate his father's favor by telling on his brothers when they do bad things. Dad, Judah didn't go graze the goats where you told him to. And so he likes to take advantage of his father's favoritism. And his brothers just can't stand him. They call him the dreamer, and he's always kind of showing off his superiority. He has dreams of how the sun and the moon and the stars all bow down to him. And this kind of thing just is impossible for them to tolerate. So they begin scheming. And one day when they're out grazing their goat herds, Joseph is sent out to meet them with a message from his father. And they see him coming from a distance, and they just decide it's time to get rid of this guy. And when he approaches them, they grab him, they tear off his beautiful coat that his father's given him, and they throw him in an empty cistern to figure out what they're going to do with him next. And just as they're sitting there enjoying their lunch with Joseph in the pit, a camel train comes by on its way to Egypt. It's going to be selling spices and perfumes, and they get, you know, ding, here's an idea. We can really get this guy off our hands while keeping our hands relatively clean by selling him to these merchants. So they sell Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. They sell him into slavery, and they douse his coat with goat's blood and bring it back to their father and say, looks like he got eaten by an animal. And his father goes into just desperate mourning as a result of that. Joseph is taken to Egypt, and I'm going to try to keep this short, so I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs, but he ends up in prison. And the thing about Joseph is that he's very magnetic to people, and he knows how to take advantage. He's been doing it his whole life, taking advantage of his beauty and his intelligence to get in with those who have power. And he knows how to do that. He knows how to take advantage of any situation to his own benefit. And while he's in prison, he wins over the prison guards and he wins over the prisoners both. And he's eventually promoted to be the overseer of the other inmates. But he has a special gift, and he knows that it's not his gift. He recognizes that this gift comes from God, and that is that he has the gift of interpreting dreams. And he interprets the dreams of the prisoners. And one of the people whose dreams he interprets ends up in the court of Pharaoh. And down the road, Pharaoh begins having dreams that he doesn't understand. He's troubled night after night by these very strange images, and his own court magicians don't understand them, or at least they won't tell him what they think they may mean, because they suggest some not so happy news. And this cupbearer in the Pharaoh's court says, you know, there's this guy that's in prison who has a gift for dream interpretation. So Pharaoh brings him into the court, tells him his dreams, and Joseph says, I can't interpret your dreams, but God will give you an answer. And here's through me, and here's what I see, that there are 7 years of abundance coming in grain, and they're going to be followed by 7 years of terrible drought. And let me just put in my word of advice to you, that you need to have somebody who will take charge of collecting food in that time of abundance and storing it up so that Egypt will not starve when the famine comes. And he's always putting in those, you know, he's always saying, put in a good word for me, will you? And may I make a suggestion? And so Pharaoh recognizes this person has a special gift for management. And over a period of time, Joseph, who came to Egypt as a slave, becomes basically the chief operations officer for the kingdom of Egypt. He's in charge of all... he's just in charge of the operations, sort of the most powerful man standing next to Pharaoh. And he's in charge of the food collection. So the famine comes, the abundance comes, the famine comes, and it affects not only the kingdom of Egypt, but the whole, all the surrounding lands. And in the midst of that, Joseph's family is struggling. They have money, but they don't have food. And so Joseph's brothers are sent to Egypt by their father to buy food. And they come into the kingdom of Egypt, and they are brought before a very powerful and very imposing man. And Joseph recognizes his brothers. But he's assumed the garb and the language and the mannerisms and the culture of Egypt, and they don't recognize who he is. And of course, he's the most powerful man in Egypt next to the Pharaoh, so why would it ever occur to them? But Joseph recognizes his brothers. And so follows this push and pull between Joseph and this group of brothers. Joseph is initially hostile to them. He's suspicious. He tests them again and again. He makes accusations against them to see how they handle it. He tests their honesty by planting money and at one point a silver cup in their donkey packs, so that when they get home they find these things and they're like, how did that happen? And they're terrified they're going to get punished, so they come back to Egypt to come clean. You know, we don't know how this money ended up here, please take it. And there's a great deal of groveling that goes on the part of the brothers. And throughout all of this, Joseph, you can see that he is struggling he's struggling with very conflicted feelings in the situation, so much so that he has to keep leaving the room to go off and cry so that he can come back, you know, compose himself, come back and negotiate with them. But as this unfolds, he seems to want more and more to be in relationship with them. And at one point, they come into Egypt, and they're greeted by his servant, who says, please come, my master is waiting for you. They're brought into his court, and they're fed dinner like honored guests, and they don't understand why this is. In fact, they've come to admit that they had money that was planted on them. They don't know how it got there. And Joseph actually serves his brothers dinner, which in the time and place would have been an outrageous condescension. They're separated by their cultures. These are Hebrew shepherds who would have been considered unclean by the Egyptians. And so for this very powerful man to actually serve dinner to these lowly shepherds is very puzzling. But it shows that he's struggling to come back to them. He's struggling to come back into relationship with them. Joseph asks, and as in his conversations, he's always trying to find out about his family and his father and his little brother Benjamin. Well, Joseph asks that Benjamin be brought to the kingdom. His father Jacob had four wives, and most of his brothers are half-brothers, but Benjamin is his full-blooded brother, the only other son born to Joseph's mother and his father. And he has a special feeling about Benjamin, who was just a little toddler when he left home. So he asked for Benjamin to be brought to him, and when he sees Benjamin, he can't hold back his feelings any longer, and he just begins to sob. And he orders all of the Egyptian servants out of the room, and so he's just there with his family, and he reveals to them who he is. And they're terrified because they think, you know, they know what they did. They've had a long time to feel ashamed of it and feel remorse for it. And here he is, a man of such power. And they're afraid they're going to be punished. But he says, don't be afraid. I forgive you because God's hand has been working through all of this. If you hadn't sold me into slavery, I would not be here now to save the family and, in fact, to save a kingdom of people from starvation. So through all of this, God has worked a great deliverance. And that's what he comes to through the whole thing. And the happy ending is he brings his family into Egypt and is reunited with his father who had thought he was dead. And there's a great catharsis and many tears and embracing. So one interesting thing is that while Joseph is in Egypt, he marries an Egyptian woman, and he has two sons. He names one of them Manasseh, which means God has made me forget all my trouble and all of my father's household. And he names the other one Ephraim, meaning God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. So you can see in the names he gives his children that he's very ambivalent about his past. God has made me forget all my trouble. Not really. And all my father's household. No, not really. And God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. So he's truly someone who, in spite of all that he has achieved, he's in an alien land. He's not with his people. He's broken from his past. And he has made the very best of his life. But there are wounds there. And so he has to work through all of that to come back into relationship with his family. And he so clearly wants to do that. Now in Gerrit Marin's poem, Family Reunion, we hear this very poignant description of people who are all too accustomed to brokenness, divorce, and estrangement at every level. And the poem implores us gently to become less well-adjusted to all of that estrangement from our roots, from our pasts, from our histories, and to begin to turn back to them, to begin to encounter who we have been more fully, especially those aspects that we've not wanted to meet, that we have not wanted to embrace or to hold. She writes, adults grow estranged from a God evidently divorced from history, and most are cut off from their own histories, each of which waits like a child left at daycare. What if you turned back for a moment and put your arms around yours? Yes, you might be late for work. No, your history does not smell sweet like a toddler's head. But look at those small round wrists, that short-legged comical walk. Caress your history. Who else will? Promise to come back later. Pay attention when it asks you the simple questions. Where are we going? Is it scary? What happened? Can I have more now? Who is that? My message here is not that we should rush to forgive what cannot be forgiven or what we are not ready to forgive. And it's not that we should always make up with family members from whom we are estranged. Unlike Joseph's brothers who wrestled with their consciences about what they did to him and who have come to remorse and responsibility, sometimes our family members or we ourselves remain fixed in unconsciousness, in denial, in self-righteousness. Sometimes reconciliation between people is difficult or impossible. And yet the story of Joseph and the poem of the family reunion speak to something in us that wants to return to wholeness, that wants to understand and reintegrate the roots of who we are, that wants to dissolve and heal the points of alienation and brokenness from our past, so that we can know ourselves fully, so that we can become ourselves fully. We can know who we are. Joseph was not just an Egyptian official. That was a costume that he put on. His people were Hebrews, Canaanite shepherds, and that is who he was at a deep level. And that's why he was so emotional when he met his family again. He no longer wanted to deny where he came from. So perhaps as we come into our season of family encounters and family reunions, and sadly sometimes come into an awareness of our family estrangements and our losses, we can still ask ourselves, is there some piece of this that is ready to be healed, that is ready to be mended? Is there some piece of this, of my history, that I am now ready to accept, to face, to reconcile with, that I'm ready to recognize? Is there something that I have heretofore pushed away that I'm ready to embrace as part of who I am in all my wholeness? In our winding journeys, guided by the Spirit's whispers and proddings, the Spirit's offers of opportunity to knit back together what has been broken, let us take up those opportunities, whether that knitting happens within ourselves or between ourselves and those with whom we are born into this world as members of our family. May it be so. I invite you.